Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Drevens.
The thing I found remarkable talking to Sunny is the inextricable link between his dental school experience and him being a reservist whilst at dental school, and how that has almost come together like a twine. They're twisted together and continue to be twisted together.
It's interesting, because I was trying to work it out. So it must be maybe 20 years. I don't know how old Sonny is, but, you know, that is sort of part of his DNA in the way that he approaches things and discards things. That's the thing I quite like about it, is the fact of, okay, it didn't work, right, park it, move on. That didn't work, park it, move on. Didn't like that, park it, move on. And I think sometimes people can spend so long thinking about whether they're going to move on or not. They'd be better off just like making a decision. You know, it's that procrastination we sort of think.
I think sometimes I remember somebody used the analogy of a monkey in the jungle. And they said, when a monkey's in the jungle, to grab the next branch, you have to let go of the branch you're holding.
So you've got to be in the midair.
So there's at some point where you have to let go of the thing you're doing to have the capacity to get to the next stage. And with Sonny, he's got a real knack of trying things and having the ability to move on. But that's led him to where he is. But genuinely, people will hear when they listen to the episode, he's the brightness in his voice, the passion come through for the project that he's involved in. And it's exciting.
And they should listen to the parachute story.
Yes.
There you go. That's not a teaser.
That's wonderful. Yeah, that was brilliant. Really good chat with him, yeah. Here we are again.
Yet another one of the Dentology podcast.
It's quite remarkable, isn't it, to think that when we started this, it was kind of a little of an embryo of an idea, and now we're the other side of 100 episodes.
It is amazing, really. It's amazing, I think, one, that we've got to 100. I think I also find it amazing that people are listening and then listening in higher, larger, longer numbers, which is... It must be interesting, which is somewhat fascinating.
Also, the interesting guests just keep coming. I think as a profession, dentistry just has this this rich depth of people who are doing interesting things, different things, and innovative things. And we've got one today. We're very, very fortunate. So today we have Dr. Sandeep Sadana joining us. And Sandeep is a dentist, director of the Direct Restorative Excellence, known as Dr. Dre, which I think is the coolest thing in the world. But he's known as Sonny. So let's welcome him as Sonny. How are you doing, Sonny? Are you well?
Morning. Yeah, good, guys. Morning. Thank you for having me.
No, not pleasure. Not at all. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. I think there's lots of elements of your journey and career so far that I think people can take a lot from. What's nice about this podcast is that we like hearing people's life stories.
Much more interesting
and from that, the business tips flow. And when I was kind of doing some research and reading about you, there's so much in what you've done so far, and people are going to take bundles from it. So I'd recommend you kind of
get... Poor old Sonny. Look at that. Yeah, right. Flip, Sonny. You've got to be interesting and inspirational in one go. You know, no pressure. It's fine. Thanks very much.
No, Sean. I think people need a notebook and a pen for this episode. I think there's going to be a lot in it.
But not if you're driving.
No, exactly. Exactly. To start off, how are you? Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I'm super well, man. And just quick one as well. Got to do the obligatory compliments up front, right? But what you guys have done is amazing as well. Super inspirational, right? Super inspirational. FTA Law, FTA thank Media, you. FTA Finance. Is there anything you guys don't do?
FTA dating, but we might do FTA dentistry dating.
No, thank you very much. I mean, I think what we try to do is, you know, this podcast is the business of dentistry. And I think we've tried to support dentists in as many non-clinical ways as possible. It's kind of all the business stuff. And actually, and you would know this, you know, you spend 5 years minimum at dental school becoming a really good clinician technician. And for many dentists, the business skills don't come that naturally. So if we can support people on that side of their career and their life, that's a good thing. And all the things we've done have kind of naturally flowed from that as an approach. So, no, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Just to kind of give ourselves some context, we'll get to your dental bit in a minute, but in what ways did your parents set you up for the person that you are today? What was your childhood like?
Well, that's deep already, isn't it? That's going well deep immediately.
We might as well dive in at the deep end. There's being in a shallow end with our water wings on.
For sure, for sure. Well, interestingly, I always try and come on podcasts and say stuff that I haven't said before as well, because there are some people that have heard me speak so many times, it gets a bit boring if they hear the same old spiel. So I'll probably just be quite open and honest about something interesting. So growing up in an Indian family, there's lots of things that come with that, right? Especially you've probably heard the common cliche, which is, you know, Indian parents want you to be a doctor, dentist and all that kind of stuff. And that is supremely true. Yeah. The other side to it as well is like, you know, arranged marriages, like they are a thing. They actually are a thing. And so my mom actually had arranged marriage when she was very young. Like we're talking like 18. And then I was born 19. And then that didn't really work out. So it was me and my mom for a long part of my life, right? So it was just us two.
Wow.
And I pretty much grew up in a shop, which was my uncle's shop. So my mom was just hard working.
Just on that, Sonny, how was that? Obviously, from an age and a culture and a moment in time, how did that play out within the family that your parents obviously didn't stay together? Was that a challenging time for your mum?
Oh, I can't imagine how difficult that must have been as a young lady, you know, two parents that were born in India. And then, you know, my granddad came over to India, left his family there, you know, very little money in his pocket, that type of, you know, rags to riches type of story. Was able to work factory to bank to that kind of stuff in the 70s, 60s, 70s as a turban wearing bearded man. I'm sure that was pretty difficult as well.
Then
managed to save enough money to actually get the family over. And then my mom was actually the first one to be born of the family in the UK. So there's probably like a bit of a disconnect as well, you know, like growing up in the UK from traditional parents, there is, that's a bit of a thing, I suppose, that's less spoken about. People who come from sort of immigrant families and what they grow through, because it's quite a cultural shift. Like you're brown enough to be Indian, but you're also not white enough to be English type of deal, right? So there's that kind of where do you fit type of deal. So I think she probably encountered that. I probably encountered that a little bit as a youngster as well. But yeah, it certainly had big effects on the family, right? That's quite a big deal for Indian.
Where did you grow up, Sonny?
So I was born in Hackney, grew up in Walthamstow and always lived around there. So my uncle's shops were in Walthamstow. So that's where pretty much I spent most of my days, because obviously my mum would drop me there in the morning. She'd go to work, you know, trying to put food on the table and doing the best she can as a single parent, right? And then, I'd come home to the shop and then she'd pick me up after dinner. So, yeah, difficult, I'd say, for her more than me, because I was a kid, right? What do you really know at that time? You realise the effects later, right?
Did your uncle get you to work in the shop? So did you sort of do, you know, shelf stacking? I'm just thinking as to, is this part of your friendliness and service culture and you know, is that an early age? So, as you know, you were already working, even though it might have been sort of like very low key, but you were learning these skills then. Because whenever I've met you, you're an extremely affable,
very personable,
chap, you know, and I know that's part of, you know, your nature, but it's also part of your experience you've learned from. I was just wondering, is that sort of what you did as well at an early age, you know, developed a work ethic?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, you need to spend a lot of time with Indians. You'll find that straight away. They're going to put you to work immediately, right? So, so me and my cousins, yeah, I mean, we grew up in a shop, learned the ropes, you know, and, you know, you grow up watching these two uncles, again, you know, turbans and big beards in the East End of London, and then how they deal with people and how they were part of the community and all the rest of it. Like, it does rub off on you, right? I think, yeah, there's a lot to be said for just getting in the mud, so to speak.
Did they pay you?
With, like, you know, with hugs and kisses and the occasional backhand.
But I think it's funny, isn't it? Mentors come in different shapes and sizes, don't they? Mm-hmm. You know, and quite often those early years, you know, in your case, it was uncles, but they also instilled something in you around, you know, work ethic and values. And it, you know, you've mentioned about kind of turbans and beards a couple of times. There's a pride in there as well. Yeah, you know, you'd be proud of who you are, and it isn't necessarily always going to be easy, but you should still remember kind of your heritage and your culture, because that's a real anchor, isn't it? You know, that's like your roots that you don't want to lose.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, for sure. And I mean, from a cultural perspective too, like my granddad, like he actually died when I was 2 years old, so I didn't really get to see him too much. But he had this big thing, and it runs in our family that, you know, where you are, you're like, where you lay your hat, that's your home. Like, you treat that, you know, with respect type of deal. So that's like a big, big running theme in my upbringing, right? It's not so much like, you know, wherever you work, yeah, pretty much that's pretty much it. Wherever you are, you know, you get stuck in with that society that you know, community.
Yeah, you immerse yourself, don't you?
Yeah. So did that those early years work ethic, did that make you a studious young Sonny? Were you good at school?
You know, funny enough, surprisingly to many, I was. And one of those things, and to be frankly honest, right, out of all the kids in my family, I was the naughty one. Right, I was the naughty one.
Right.
But I got away with it because I got the grades. Right, so that was, my uncle used to say to me all the time, he'd say, you get the grades, do what you want type of deal. Right? So I think I just took that to the extreme. I was like, I've got the A, you're like, leave me alone. So, yeah, and certain things like that rubbed off as well. Like, one of my uncles was really big on, like, English and language and how we communicate, and it's super important, you know, it's so important. Mm. You know, you could say one thing, you could say the exact same thing in two different ways and it can elicit a completely different response.
Oh, right? Yeah, so much.
So one of his things was, you know, I'd get dropped off to the shop like really early, 6:30, and these guys are working, you know, these are the, you know, we come back to talking about hard work and stuff, right? You know, sometimes dentists, we think we work hard, but actually I think people who run shops and people who are waiters and that's hard work. You know, we all work hard, right? So it's probably not worth comparing. Like, everyone works hard, so that's not a variable I rely on. I think that's actually a constant if you want to try and do stuff. But he was really big on that, so he'd make me read like The Independent at like 5 years old, 6 years old, like, read it, you know.
Oh, wow.
And just really encouraged me to read the newspaper to him while he was putting them out. So that, I reckon that had an effect. You know, these are all things that you realize much later in life. These formative experiences that you don't attribute to anything. You think it's all you, right? Oh, yeah, I'm good at English. Mm. Well, maybe not necessarily. Maybe there was some, you know, little seeds that were planted that helped.
Mm. Mm. But that's fascinating, because also when you're reading the Telegraph or the Independent or whatever it might be to your uncle, not only are you practicing your English, but you're also absorbing those stories, aren't you? Mm. So you're starting to build your real rounded picture of the world. Oh, it's brilliant, actually, because the inputs that, you know, a lot of people nowadays, they get, you know, Instagram and Facebook. Mm-hmm. Really.
But it's a really smart way of developing you as a young person, but without just sitting you in front of books
and
learning stuff. You know, you're acquiring skills, and it kind of gives some kind of context and makes sense why you're personable and why you're a good speaker and why you're somebody who engages. And that would have kind of gone back to those very early years of things that happened then. So you said, and we have heard it a number of times before, you know, doctor, lawyer, dentist, those are your choices. It's either that or a failure, you know, which one do you want to be? So of the limited choices you had, why did you choose dentistry? Why was that the one that piqued your interest?
Well, this is, you know, everyone gives this really poignant answer at this point, right? And I'm not going to. The truth was, I was getting good grades, and it was a case of, you know, those choices. And I spoke to, you know, a family friend who was a GP, and she kind of said to me, you know what, dentistry is better. And then coming from a GP who was, you know, that held a lot of weight. Then I remember in college, one of my, you know, my good friend at the time, who he said to me, look, let's go check it out. So then we went down for an open day at Queen Mary, and they were like, oh, and you get to play football every Wednesday afternoon. And I was like, yeah, I'm sold. And that was pretty much it, right? So I got the grades, got the opportunity, and yeah, just took it, really.
Cool.
So you played football.
Yeah, you played football as well. So you went to Queen Mary.
That's right, yeah.
And what was your dental school experience like? We speak to people who are in their 50s, and what they talk about is almost unbelievable compared to somebody like, sorry, to Tane, who's literally just graduated from King's. So he's kind of literally just left, and you're kind of that midpoint where, you know, you qualified
perhaps,
with a few years.
Perhaps you should caveat that. What's your dental school experience that you can recount?
Yes.
Yeah. It was a mixed experience, actually, right? The dental school, I found it really regimented, right? And I found first year really tough, right? Because every 6 weeks you're having this exam. So that's pretty militant, right? When everybody else is like doing freshers and stuff, right? And just going out.
Yeah, they're just enjoying themselves, yeah.
And you're just under the cosh, right? And it was actually really strict. I remember my first day walking in, and this lady, I won't say her name now, but she basically pulled me aside and said, you can't dress like that. And I had a tracksuit on, and she had like a big problem with it. And I was like, yeah,
seriously?
I just feel like, yeah, seriously. So attitudes have changed massively, right? But she had like such a problem with how I dressed. And I was like, damn, like, you know, shit, what have I signed up for? Yeah, that kind of
yeah,
feeling.
Yeah.
And then, it was just intense. You know, people by and large were pretty cool, but I think I started to realize, like, oh, you know, is this from very early on, is this what I wanted to do? And long story, what I always wanted to do was so my mum got remarried, like my stepdad, he was in the TA, so I got really influenced by the Army Reserve stuff. And then and then both my uncles were like in the air cadets as kids, and they had like really fond memories of it. And so I was always drawn to this kind of stuff. Like I was inspired again. I've talked about the uncles a lot, but we talk about the early experiences. And one of my uncles was like, he'd be behind the till, and when there wasn't sort of like he wasn't doing anything, he'd pick up a dumbbell and just start doing some curls and stuff. So I was really influenced by physical culture very early on. My mum's really into keep fit as well. And so I always wanted to do something with the army. Like I just always wanted to do that. And then I was at this, you know, you do the trade fair. And then I saw the army stand. I went over and they said, yeah, you know, we create officers. Like, you want to be an officer? I was like, I didn't even know the difference really. What was, you know, officer and a soldier and an NCO and all this. I was like, yeah, cool. Signed up and then joined the reserves. And then that's really what got me through uni. That was the thing I enjoyed the most. That was really like, really, really engaging for me. Whereas dentistry was like, I was there to get a degree. I was there to, you know, create a future. But beyond that, I really just focused on doing what I was required to do. And then just all the rest of my time so really dedicated
that, did,
on
so did that end up you kind of almost having two worlds whilst in dental school? Did you actually hang out with the dental students that much, or in your downtime were you heading towards the sort of reservist side of things?
Yeah, that's that was
what reserve regiment were you in?
So it's called an officers training corps. It was London. So
The HSC,
and that was actually set up during like World War, you know, because they needed to produce a lot of officers.
Yeah,
so they got quite a history. I think I don't know the exact percentage, but quite the large majority of officers actually come from those places. So then they're dotted around the country, right? And so many of my friends became officers from there.
I said, were you tempted to go into the MOD or Army dentistry or?
Well, this is it, right? I think I was living in a bit of la-la land. Like I really like the green stuff. I love, you know, I know it's a bit un-PC, but, you know, I liked shooting. I liked running around. I liked all that kind of stuff. I liked, you know, like boxing and, you know, all those types of things that you kind of get pat on the back for, but in any other context, you're like, oh, you monster. So it was quite cool. And I enjoyed the fact that there, if you had a problem, like you just sort it out with the other bloke, you know, and then however it goes down in the morning, he'll probably sit next to you for breakfast and go, that was funny, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's really enjoyable, a place like that. And I've lost my train of thought now. What was you saying?
That was whether you thought about becoming a dentist in the army.
I did. Actually, I did want to do that, because then I started to think to myself, I'm doing all this fun green stuff. And then when I speak to other people who actually have gone into sort of professional roles in the army, you don't do that much green stuff. You're just a dentist in a uniform.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's kind of like the two worlds. Was dentistry was quite difficult in a lot of ways. Yeah, very regimented. Well, and the army's very regimented as well, but regimented doing the things I wanted to do, right? And so I did want to kind of blur the two, and then I'm not really getting benefits from either anymore, so that was a difficult decision to make at the end of the degree, right? Do I go full time as an army dentist, which I decided didn't really want to do? And then the question became, do you stay as a reservist? But again, now I'm gearing up towards family life and all the rest of it. It's a massive time commitment, and you know, unpopular view here as well is actually I got quite jaded with the whole military thing by the end of it, because you see people come back from Iraq, you see people, you know, you see firsthand experiences of what this does, you know, then you start to get clued up. When you're 18, you don't know anything. When you're 23, you've been around it, you start getting clued up to the politics of it all. And you start thinking, oh man, you know, I'm not sure I really believe in this cause here. You know, I'm not really too sure sending young people to their deaths over something that's really politically motivated. I'm not sure I could get behind it. So a little bit unpopular of a view, but made the decision to actually walk away at that point.
Just before we kind of segue back into the dental side of things, can you talk us through your first parachute jump?
I can actually. Funny enough, I was at one of my mates, he's a paratrooper, at his wedding on the weekend, and it always gets brought up, right? So we're in a taxi going to the venue, and there's a car full of paratroopers and an artilleryman. He's like, mate, do you know what happened to, they call me Deep, right? They go, do you know what happened to Deep on his first jump? And he's like, no, what happened? And then obviously the story ensues. So with the military, you do a lot of training. Yeah, you know, you're very much an independent. You got to be capable, right? Everything's about being capable. It's a full meritocracy. Yeah, if you could do the job, fantastic, right? There is no, he's not that good enough, but we'll let him in. Nah, you got to be good. You got to pass the test. It's all standardized, right? So it's the same with jumps. They're not going to let you jump unless they know you're safe. So typically, most people when they do a parachute jump, what do? They're strapped to a professional, aren't they? And you get to enjoy the ride. Yeah? You haven't got to worry about anything. Not with the army, right? You do, you know, a day of like, maybe a day and a half, I can't remember now, it's quite a while ago. And you do, you know, lots of training, lots of drilling to make sure you know what to do should something go wrong. And then, yeah, we're going in this little box plane, you know, right, rickety old thing into the air, and you're all strapped in one after the other. So if somebody doesn't jump, the others can't jump, right? So I can't remember where I was like third or fourth or something. And you've got a jump master who's very experienced, you know, guy with a helmet and a camera and all the rest of it. And he's looking at you, and he's like, "You ready?" And, you jump out the side in these planes, right? Now, what this is, it's a static line.
Is it that means static line? Oh, exactly. Thank you. I was going to say, was it a static line? Yeah.
Take some of the guesswork out for you at least, right? So for your first jump, you're by yourself. And as you jump out, you haven't got to actually deploy the parachute because it's attached to a line. And that means once you get a certain distance away from the plane, it pulls the chute out for you. So there I am hanging out this plane. And this, when I tell you the wind is hitting you fiercely in the face, yeah? I don't think I've ever felt anything that intense. Like, you know, I've ridden motorbikes, but that was in your face, right? And you're half dangling out. And then he's looking, he's like, "You ready?" I'm like, "Yeah." And then, you know, you've got this posture that you need to jump out, almost like a backwards banana type of deal. So you get caught by the, all this good stuff. And you remember all this, you do it. And I thought I did everything to a T. And as I did it, I'm falling. And then I feel a little bit of resistance and then I'm still falling. And then I look up and this parachute is a ball of washing and it didn't deploy properly. And my right arm was caught in the line.
Oops.
Oh, no. So there I am, falling towards the ground pretty damn quickly. I don't know if it's terminal velocity, but probably close to, right? You're going pretty damn quick. And then you need to get rid of that parachute and you need to deploy the second one, which is spring loaded. So it's very unlikely that that one's going to go wrong. That one comes out, you grab the toggle above your head, you grab both sides, you do your little tests. And then, you know what? That's a testament to how fantastic military training is, right? You can have all the views in the world on them, but guess what? They know how to train people really well because it worked. The training paid off and there I was floating down. And that's when every expletive I had in my vocabulary came out, right? And then if you were an atheist, I'll tell you what, you start to believe in something at that point.
Oh, what an amazing story.
Yeah,
and in that moment, you say about kind of conditioned training. Yeah, it's a bit like, I guess, being like an airline pilot and something going wrong. You fall back into your training incredibly quickly. Did it feel quite instinctive and intuitive what you had to do because the training was so good?
100%. 100%.
Without that did training, you jump again?
Yeah, the next day.
Ah, there we go.
So,
good, man.
Well, it's interesting, though, because I had a rough landing, I'll tell you that, though. But I tell you, actually, I remember the landing too, because that's part of the story too, right? So, I had a bit of a rough landing. You know, there's a particular way to land, but I was quite flustered at this point, right? You know, as you can imagine, naturally.
Reasonably so.
Yeah. And so what you're supposed to do, you're supposed to like put the brakes on just before you touch the ground. So then you go like, I mean, no one's going to be able to see my hand movement, but you go like this and you just gently fall to the ground. And instead, I pulled the thing too early. And then when you let go, you actually accelerate and I accelerated into the ground. So that was fun.
Ooh.
And then there was a wagon waiting for me. Right, so they've driven up like, you know, two grunts from Neverhaven Air Base, and then they come in the wagon and they're like looking at me and they're like, "Well, get in the wagon then, I'm not going to help you." So then I'm there and they're like, "Grab your parachute as well." And then I'm like dragging this parachute behind me, grabbing it up, put it over my shoulder, get into the back of the wagon, just lie down and go, "Oh my god." Yeah. just that was it. So I was like, no mercy as well. And then I remember the guy at the time, Lieutenant Story. He kind of took me around the corner. He's like, he put his hand on my shoulder. He's like, "You all right, mate?" And I'm like, "Yeah, no, I'm good." He goes, "You've done very well." He goes, "Look, get the evening off, yeah? You and your guys will get the evening off." He says, "What do you fancy, a KFC?" So they took us off base, took us for a KFC. That was cool. And then one of my pals, and, you know, at the time, all of us wanted to be paratroopers, right? That was the thing, yeah? Either paratroopers or Marines. You know, there's like this little rivalry.
Yeah.
And so my particular group of pals all wanted to be paratroopers, and a lot of them went on to do it. And then this particular one, he's like, stoic guy, right? He's a stoic guy, and he's looking at me going, "Mate, I don't think I can jump." And I was like, "Geezer, we've got to jump. If we don't jump tomorrow, we'll never jump again, right?" And so the freakiest part of all of this, we're up in this plane the next day and we're in a box plane. There's one behind below us and we're watching all the guys jump out of the plane below, and another guy had a malfunction. So the probabilities are just like so low, right? But it's just a bit freaky. So can you imagine how that shook me and him? But they got, you know, the army values are like courage, discipline, and respect for others. He's a big 3R, remember, that carried on. And mate, it's courage. You've got to dig deep, right? And I just look at it as probabilities, right? It's unlikely to happen to me again unless somebody really didn't like me.
And make sure it wasn't the same parachute packer.
Exactly.
But in terms of life skills, I mean, it's pretty extreme, but what an experience to have gone through.
Sure. I mean, many others, yeah. But that was quite.
So bringing it back to the tame old world of dentistry, because sure. Now kind of, you know, everyone's heart's racing and they're listening to the remarkable story.
As he jumps out of the chair,
yeah,
with no parachute.
So yeah. Thinking about your dental school experience, we get quite a lot of students and younger dentists, or even aspirational dentists, listening to this. What would you kind of give them as your golden tip? What was the thing you learned going through dental school?
Don't jump out of a plane.
Yeah. Well, it's probably a bit late for that. But before dental school, I reckon it's best to go and really spend time with dentists and see what their working life is and speak to experienced ones and work out, is this really what you want to do? Because when you're young, you think about prospects, yeah? You think about, right, you know, I could work a 9-to-5, earn really good money, help people, do creative work with my hands. It all sounds really good. What's the downsides? People don't tell you about the downsides. The downsides is, well, back pain is rife through dentistry. Yeah. It's crippling back and neck pain people have. Funniest thing is you ask a dentist, does your back hurt? Nope, not mine. You know, it's almost like you can't tell anyone.
You can't admit it.
It's almost like an admission of failure, is it, if your back
hurts? You're a liability as well, aren't you? If you say to, and I know this firsthand because one of the practices I was in, my back started to really pack up, yeah, really started to have problems. And I think I'm pretty physically fit, I'd say, you know, and my back really started to hurt after doing sort of the 6 day, you know, when you started to do, everyone goes through it, you go and start doing 6 days, you go, oh, I made all this money in 5 days, let me do six. And then you start getting on that kind of hamster wheel. And, you know, people save up for houses and all the rest of it. You've got to do what you've got to do. I get it. You're young once type of deal. But that became really quite crippling for me. So that's, I'd say actually find out about the occupational hazards, find out about what's entailed in the work, find out the downsides before you actually say, I want to go be a dentist. Probably do your due diligence. You know, I've got this kind of adage when it, you know, a business adage that whenever I'm doing anything, especially if the decision's irreversible, I ask myself, what are the alternatives? You know, and I really try to contemplate what they are, right? And think, and it's the same for somebody before one of the biggest decisions of their life, what they're going to do for the rest of their life, should probably go and think, what are my alternatives? And why are they that?
I think that's really good. I think that's really good advice. I mean, thankfully, whilst people don't think about it in the moment, most decisions are reversible. We quite often don't think they are, but they are. They are reversible. And thinking through that process is a healthy thing to do. You've said that, and this is a long period of time, you know, post qualification. But you said you struggled in dentistry and with dentistry for the first 8 years. Why was that? Why was it challenging for you? Aside from, you know, the health issue, what was it?
Well, I'd say number one, I don't think I really maximised uni, if I'm being brutally honest, self-reflective, in that I did the requirements of me and that was it, right? And then there'll be other students who'd be there and they'd jump onto an extra clinic or they'd be like, oh, you finished with your chair? And then you'd go and then they'd jump in your chair and do something. You know, there was people who were maximising their time. I don't think I did that as well. So again, that's the advice to the people who are in dental school. Max it out. You know, make your dollar sweat. You know, really get the value, right? You know, you've paid for this degree, you're paying, you know, ancillary costs to stay there and eat and all the rest of it. Well, get bang for your buck, right? So speaking to lecturers there, getting an insight, you know, just making friends, you know, really doubling down on why you're there and what the objective is. I think that makes a lot of sense. I don't really think I did the max in that regard. So then you get out, and then I did VT, and thankfully my vocational training was in Charlton, it's like South London, and I had a fantastic trainer, really, really kind person, really just can't say enough words, you know, about how he believed in me more than I believed in myself at the time, right? Because I'm looking at this going, you know, when calamities are happening, where things are going so wrong with procedures, and he's just there going, look, don't worry about it, this happens. You're not going to do that again, are you? I was like, hell no. So, you know, it was having that kind of encouragement behind you. His name is Mr. Keeley, you know, for anyone who wants to know, right? But honestly, one of the most respected people in my life, right? Because just believed and just was a fantastic teaching style. His teaching style rubbed off on me as well, very much to, you know, you've got tell, show, do, but there's also ask a question, let the person answer, let them figure it out for themselves. Like that's supremely beneficial, especially for my learning style. Very engaged. So I really adopt that a lot. So that was all right. And I improved a lot and I learned more in that 1 year. But I could have maxed out the VT year with somebody like that in my corner if I had actually paid attention more so in uni. You with me? So that was that. Then after that, you go into the real world, right? And there I was, dropped into NHS dentistry, right? And, you know, many people think you have to go and do VT and then go into the NHS. You don't. I actually know a bloke who studied abroad, came back, went straight into private, did almost, you know, inverted commas VT with his older cousin. And this guy is probably one of the top earners in the country now, right? So there are unconventional methods, and I'd say I'm an unconventional person, and it was just a shame that stuff like that wasn't available to me. But just to open your eyes that there are other means. Because I went into the NHS thinking that's what you had to do. And then, you know, 20, 30 patients a day, you're really in the deep end. And then what I felt like, it was the door was shut behind you. Like, get on with it. You've got 7,000 UDAs to do, you know, and it's just like immense pressure to deliver. That was quite tough. And then, there's something to be said about mentorship and support. You know, you can go to practices that are really supportive. And I think as an early dentist, that's going to be your friend. Whereas I just went with whatever was available. Oh, that's a job, I'll take
it. Just on that point, Sonny, it was recently said, wasn't it, that there might be this lock-in for dental students post-qualification, that they'll need to commit a certain amount of time to the NHS. And whilst I'm just against the idea of a lock-in, I think you should create an environment where people want to be there as opposed to they have to be there because they're told to. However, working in the NHS as a newly qualified dentist, it does give you a lot of patients to see, a lot of experience. You can learn and hone your chairside manner and communication skills. So are you saying that if you had your time again, you would have not taken that route and gone privately? And do you think you'd have developed at the same speed or quicker if you'd have gone down that path? Or are there things that working on the NHS early on in your career do provide?
I think in my context, the NHS VT, like I said, when Mr. Kilo was priceless, right? It was invaluable for me, right? And I'm sure that's the case for many people. I'm just saying, if I was switched on and had my eyes on the prize and said, look, what's my goal? What am I trying to do within the next 5 years? I would have looked for a supportive practice that was private and say, look, I don't know everything. This is what I've done in uni. Like, I've gone over and above. Here's what I want to do. I know what to treat and I know what not to treat. That's very attractive to me. If you have a young person that says, I know what I shouldn't do, that's equally as important as them being able to do the things that they can do.
Yeah.
So I just think there's that could be a leveraged opportunity for the right people is what I'm getting at here.
So you had a period where you weren't that enamored with dentistry, but then back in 2018, you fell back in love with it. And was that the time that you met your mentor?
A little bit before that, actually. Just that was a couple of years before that actually happened. But obviously I had a rough spell with the whole NHS thing and then trying to move private and then realizing that, 6 years in, I got the opportunity to join a squat practice. It's actually a friend from uni, and took that up. Very, very difficult. People also underestimate what it is to jump from what they're doing. There's almost like that safety in what you're already doing, yeah? Because then you move from this NHS job that pays really well. Let's be frank. You're doing 7,000-8,000 UDAs a year and a little bit private on top. That's good money for a young person. And then you go to private and you're like, yeah, it's going to be better. You know, I'm like, see ya, suckers type of deal, feeling in my head that this is going to be, you know, like I got this, you know, your ego starts to inflate. I'm private now, inverted commas, right? You feel. And then you get there, and actually my take home that year was like 30-ish K, something like that. And that was brutal for you know, someone having a young family and a child and a mortgage. But, you know, it was deferred gratification. That's one thing I'm quite good at, is actually I can really think long-term. That was something. I think after a succession of failures, you start to realize that quick money and quick success just isn't the route for everybody. And that is like almost you have to build a wide foundation before you can go upwards. So I kind of really got forced to embrace the long-term perspective.
So you said about failures. What was kind of the process that you went through? What things did you try? Did you experiment with that didn't work out for you? And I'm not kind of putting you on the spot to say, come on, tell us all your failures. But I think it's a part of life that people don't talk about enough. And the reality is, I think it was Bill Gates said that success is a terrible teacher. You know, failure is where you learn all your lessons. So what are the things that you kind of gave a whirl and just didn't quite work out for you?
Well, loads of things. And I think also what we get is, when you're under pressure, when things aren't working out for you, it's a highly emotional state, right? It's not a logical. When you're in a position of power, i.e. you're making all the money you need to make, you can make really good decisions because you're not doing things for money and material need, right? You know, Maslow's hierarchy. You're not doing it for food, shelter and all of that sort of stuff. Now you're doing it for other things like purpose, meaning and la la la. So when you're in that highly emotional state where, you know, the rude awakening of being a private dentist and actually not being that good, because a lot of the stuff you do privately, like composites and stuff like that, you're only doing them every now and then on the NHS. And the things that you're just doing every now and then, you're not going to be good at, unfortunately. And neither was I. So I actually had more complaints, more refunds, more all of that type of stuff, redoing treatment for free privately than I ever did as an NHS. The NHS patients were happy with what I was doing. You with me? So that inflates your ego too, because you're like, well, my patients love me. I must be good. Then you get to private. You know, I actually remember my first patient. He comes in and I still had that NHS hat on, and he takes his jacket off and he had an Arsenal top on. And I said to him, you know, I pointed to the door and I said, you're in the wrong place, like making a joke. That did not go down well at all. And that was my first day in private. You with me? It's a steep learning curve when you're not in it. And that was a relationship I could never recover, despite, you know, first impressions actually count. So you have these types of lessons again. I've actually forgot the question again. I'm sorry. I go on such tangents sometimes.
No. I was just thinking, I can imagine now in your wardrobe, you have your scrubs and you have 20 different football shirts. And depending on which patient comes in, you put on your Arsenal, your Tottenham or your Chelsea or your whatever.
I don't
mention football. Yeah.
I just keep it. How's the dog?
Yeah, do an obscure sport. Are you into hurling?
But you're right. As a in that context, the lesson to make sure that you kind of accommodate people and don't judge what you think might be funny, but somebody else might not. Sure. Yeah, those are things. But now you were just saying about the things that you tried that didn't work out for you. You sort of stepped away from dentistry for a bit, didn't you? And I think you tried to do, there was an endodontic referral service and you dabbled in Bitcoin and bits and pieces. You tried a few things, but I think it's important because what we're going to come on to in a minute, I think that was a pathway that led you to where you are now.
Sure. So I remember pick up where I was. So I was saying that actually you get this shiny object syndrome, right? Where, like I said, reflexively, you're looking for opportunities that could be the thing that are going to, you know, lead you to salvation. And at the time, 2016 kind of time, 2017, everybody was on this facial aesthetics hype, right? So everyone's like, dentists are the best people positioned to do facial aesthetics. We already understand the face. I could barely remember blood supplies around the eye. I can't remember that. I can remember the mouth, but not around the eye or the nose or any of that. But ironically, you know, we're the best people positioned because we use needles all the time. Well, it's a different type of needle. It's a different type of thickness. Like, we use one needle all day long to give anesthetic, not anything else. So I got sucked into that, you know, did a whole bunch of training courses. And I tell you what, I was so desperate. You know, you get that sunk cost fallacy, right? Where you're really trying to recoup your investment. So you're really trying to do whatever you could to pour energy and time into like this facial aesthetics on, because you've spent a good few grand on a 3-day course, right? And now you're trying to get that investment back. And then again, you're not doing it regularly. So I was never that good. And then it takes real focused effort and attention to get good at that thing. But when you're doing that thing, by default, you're not doing the other thing. So the more time you spend on facial aesthetics, the more time you're not getting better at your dentistry, right? And young dentists will always say to you, I'm thinking about doing aesthetics and implants and aligners and I'm like, okay, so what are you going to drop? Right? And there's no answer. It goes quiet. Because everyone wants it all. We're taught this thing on Instagram. You can have it all. You can have the beautiful woman and the beautiful house and the career and work 80 hours a week and have a six pack. And, you know, it's just, it's life is or sometimes, not always and, right? And so I think that was
good point.
Couldn't really make that work too well. And I actually really ran with that. And that had like a part in my life all the way up until maybe like last year, where I had my, you know, regular patients and the ones, you know, I just started sticking to the procedures I was very good at with facial aesthetics. And then last year I made the decision to actually just stop marking for it. You know, I actually had a treatment room. I actually ran courses on it. And running courses on it, it's because I thought I was a good trainer. Yeah. Like, I thought I've got a good style. And I think the military really helped with that, because you just learn very protocoled ways of thinking, right? How do you make it so anybody can come in, learn this protocol and get pretty much a good result like everybody else would, right? So I thought I was good at that. And I think I did have an edge there. The problem was I was selling the commodity. So if you go type facial aesthetics for dentists, there's tons and tons and tons. And if you think about somebody like Bob Connor, who's been doing it for how long, who trains dentists, I think I'm going to leave it to him, because he's probably the best person positioned to do that if people are serious about going into facial aesthetics as a dentist. So yeah, identifying what I should and should do became quite clear. Then I did have a stint of like being really quite not even that happy in private dental, you know, when you're working really, really hard. It's the environment too, right? You're working really hard and then you build this squat practice up as well. And you've got lots of patients now. You're doing good collections. You know, you're grossing, you know, 30K some months and doing well. And then for your percentage to be reduced each year you're there without it actually being in a written contract could actually be quite sour grapes, right? So that was one of the other emotional spurs to me to think, wow, I'm not even, and I learned from that experience with my own team now, that they've got to have skin in the game. They've got to have vested interest to make this, and they've got to see the vision the way you do. And you know what? By that point, I didn't see the vision. I wasn't on board anymore. I didn't see a future there. So you get really enamored with that too. So now you're looking for the exit. Yeah. And so the exit became a host of things. But before the Endo referral service, I caught onto Bitcoin really quite early, like 2017. I caught onto it. I was like, look, this looks really interesting. Got quite obsessed with that. I'm quite obsessive. Like, if I go into something, I'm quite dedicated. Yeah. Some would say obsessed. Yeah. Some would say disciplined. But I learned as much as I could. And an element of ignorance, right? You don't know what you don't know, right? You don't know how difficult things are. You don't know that actually, you know, being a dentist, you think you're smart. Your skills don't always transfer over, right? It's not, they don't transfer over to facial aesthetics. It's a new discipline, in my opinion. It doesn't transfer over into financial trading because it's a different discipline, requires a different skill set. And there are people who've been doing it for 20 years professionally. And now you're going to step into an arena and go, I'm going to have a go. Yeah, that's the quickest way to get slaughtered. Long story, I caught a bit of luck. I bought Bitcoin at 1,800 US dollars. And then that was like the summer of 2017. And then by Christmas, by New Year, it was worth 20 grand a piece. So my portfolio was worth $250,000 at that time. And I was like, gonna resign now.
I've made it.
I can do this all day. This is quite easy. You know, sit at my computer, having a bag of crisps, click a few buttons. You know, it sounds easy. And then 2018, the market crashed. And then, I didn't know what I was doing, right? I'm not a professional. It went from like 20K to 11K in like a couple of weeks. And I was like, what do I do? Then it bounced up to 17K. I was like, oh, I'm saved. And, you know, just the emotional heartbreak as that sort of just bled out. And I just returned to education really quite fully. Thought to myself, look, I've worked so hard for dentistry. This is what I'm at. This is what I'm in. This is what I know. You know, this is where my network is. These are the people. You know, you're trying to give that up. It doesn't make sense. You know, there's a lot of ground you've made. Unless you've got an edge somewhere else via network and something else like that. I'm not sure that makes sense. So I really went heavy on the education, did all the big names. And then it wasn't clicking for me. You know, it still wasn't clicking for me. Yeah, I got better.
You've still not found it, have you? You're still kind of wandering around looking for the thing.
Yeah, it weren't clicking for me because everywhere I went, right, and this is what I learned about commoditization as well, is that, again, with facial aesthetics, they're all teaching the same thing, let's be real, right? They're just different flavors and iterations and delivery, so it's a commodity, right? I have to ask yourself, is there someone out there that's selling what you do for cheaper? And when it comes to facial aesthetics, it's true, right? It's true. So that was a commodity type game from, you know, in that regard. And I just didn't want to get caught up in that later on. Like, I started to realize what that was, yeah? You know, you have to forgive me. I've lost my trailer for one more time. I'm really sleep deprived at the minute. We're building up to our course on Saturday.
No, honestly. It's good. It's good because it's given us that pathway.
It's wide and varied.
Well, the thing that I like is you're kind of, you know, it feels a little bit like Edison and the light bulb. You're talking about, you keep knocking off things that don't work for you, which
I got it.
Ultimately takes you towards the thing that does work for you. And I don't know how it came about, but you met the inventor of the greater curve system and who became your mentor. And was that the thing that then put you on the pathway to start your own direct restorative excellence business?
Yeah, sure. That was it, actually.
And why was that special? What was it about that encounter and that system and that experience that was different from everything that had gone before that hadn't captured your imagination?
And how did you get that encounter? Was it a chance encounter or a manufactured encounter, if that makes sense?
I like that, manufactured. So actually, I remember my point and it'll lead on to this now. So I was doing all these courses and actually, again, it was the same thing. They were all pretty much teaching the same method of working, which without getting too clinical, is like sectionals and it's the same approach and it's the same stuff pretty much, right, for everything. And I was learning that all these different flavors. But that wasn't clicking for me. Yeah, it just wasn't clicking for me, right? The common problems dentists have every day, I just couldn't solve them still. And that's like, it's a very embarrassing conversation to have with patients sometimes. So then I went on to this American forum called Dental Town. This is 2018. And that's when I found this great curve system. And I'm looking at all these cases. And at the time, they're like 17,000 posts. And then I found out this company had been around since 2006. So it's not like a fly-by-night thing. This is an established way of working, just not really commonly known in the UK. And I'm looking at these cases and it looks stupidly simple. Like two components instead of five, right? So instead of having five things, and this is like very military, right? You want to get the job done simply and reproducibly rather than layer on loads of complexity, which may give you a marginal gain and might not. So that was what struck a chord with me. So I started using this for 2 years from 2018 to 2020, and I got a lot better immediately compared to like the return I got on this small spend on a kit versus like the nearly 50K I spent on education. This was showing up in my pay packet, whereas the education wasn't necessarily. And that's not a slight on any of those trainers. They're fantastic people. And some people really resonate with that way of working. Just wasn't for me. And then I started using it. I got better, but I still had problems with that as well. Like, even though I was better, there were still nuances to this system I just didn't know. And a YouTube video can't teach you. Then in 2020, I heard this podcast called Dentistry Uncensored, which I had been listening to for years. And Dr. Brown was on that, and he's a guy in his 70s, right? He's been practicing for 40 years. And he's talking about all the same problems we are and saying bold, audacious claims that, you know, will get you put in Facebook prison if you say it out loud, right, on the dental groups. And so he's saying it as a guy in his 70s. And I'm like, well, this is interesting. And even more interesting to me was actually he was a Vietnam War veteran before he was a dentist. So he was actually in Nam before, and then became a dentist when he came back. So that was interesting. And so I emailed him. We started speaking. Then he said, look, let's jump on a Zoom. So we did. We got on. Then he's like, show me your cases. And I showed him. He's like, yeah, you need to do this. And I was like, well, that's it. And then little tricks and tips that this, he made the system. He made these techniques, right? And so I'm learning from him. And he's mentoring me for a bunch of time. And then in 21, I left associate dentistry completely and set up a referral service. So I started renting chair space and visiting other people's practices with this new skill set that, It was like the light bulb moment. I was like, wow, dentistry is fun. This is reproducible. You know, when you can get a result and you can confidently say to a patient, I can do this. Yeah. And the things that you may not be able to do, you can let them know. Look, I might not be able to do this, but I can have a good old go. This is how much the fee is. This is how much fees would you like myself to go? Yeah, let's do it. And then now you become this problem solver. So that was liberating for me. That was good. And like I said, you know, I think I'm a bit outside the box just in general. I think my whole family probably say that as well, being the naughty one. But this was that for me, because it was not the mainstream, but it had enough history and evidence to suggest that actually this really does work. Dr. Brown's cases are crazy, like, you know, mind-boggling. You know, I speak to other Greater Curve users. There's one from Canada. He's got like 10-year recalls, and I'm looking at it going, this shouldn't be possible. So, yeah, that was it. And then in the end of 21, after, like, you know, really firing on all cylinders, producing more now than I ever did in my whole career, like almost felt like making up for less time. I said to Denny, I said, look, I want to teach this. I want to create a framework. I want to formalize this. And he's like, yeah, I want you to too. So I came back with a minimum viable product, showed him, and he's like, let's do it. And that's it. The rest is history. So now we have not just the Dre composite course, but we have many other offerings now as well. So we have an anterior program, posterior program, 2-4-day. We have a year long as well, which is more focused on like production and communication and sales and all that kind of stuff for people who just really want to be top performers. But it's just morphed into something, you know, just that I didn't really think it was going to be. I actually thought it was going to be just this really cool course. Now it's turned into actually a way of practicing, a way of being.
What I love, Sonny, is your whole voice, body language, energy changed when you started talking about that. Everything before, there was a kind of a slight melancholy tone to how you were telling those stories.
Resignation.
Yeah. There was kind of a heartfelt, didn't work out. When you started talking about this, the energy just like flips. So this is obviously the thing that you really want to do and you're passionate about. And it shows.
For sure.
So what does your week look like now? You still deliver some clinical dentistry. You do a couple of days a week, is it?
About a day in total. So it can vary. I mean, that's I think one thing that people don't realize as well when they go and say, I'm going to do my own thing, is that actually how adaptable you have to be. So if you're used to having a regiment like I am, like I do very well waking up early in the morning. But of late, you know, recently I've been working late into the night because of school holidays and other stuff and all that. So you've got to be adaptable, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's my working week too. So I'll visit a clinic in Surrey a couple times a month, and that'll be on a Monday. And then I use my own chair space evenings, Wednesdays or Fridays. So it varies. It's never the same every week. So that's interesting.
Is it important for you to still, because of falling out of love in dentistry, falling back in love, and now having this system, is it important for you to continue to practice your clinical skills yourself?
Yeah, for sure. I think that goes.
Could you see yourself going to an environment where you purely become an educator?
I don't think a dental educator can exist without being wet fingered, personally.
I think right, you're right.
So that's just my stance, right? Because, you know, I'm battle testing this. And not only that, I'm developing my own techniques. Yeah. Techniques using Greater Curve that didn't exist before. You know, the partnership between me and Dr. Brown and the Greater Curve Camp. You know, so imagine being able to develop frameworks and techniques and really exciting stuff that I don't want to say just yet, because I'm the type of person to say it when it's here rather than say it when it's not. But I mean, eye-wateringly interesting stuff, especially from an hourly rate perspective. Some of the stuff that's possible using this as part of your primary tool, and then the frameworks and techniques that we're developing alongside it. So,
I must admit, I don't think it's ever been. Yeah, I don't think it's ever been more exciting when you look at the repeatability of some of these treatments, the scalability, the technology that's coming along to support clinicians. I think it's an incredible time, and I think definitely. From a patient care point of view, patients are getting better outcomes and more long-term, reliable outcomes. And I just think it's only going to get better. I think the technology that's appearing in dentistry, as a non-clinician, you know, I talk to lots of dentists, and the excitement in the profession at the moment for where it's heading, that's a lot of it's kind of tech supported, is quite remarkable.
I totally agree with that. However, my counter to that is this: technology is there to make our life better, right? It's not there to layer on layers of complexity, and then you kind of feel that you have to use this thing because everybody else is. Is it giving you better outcomes? Is it reflected in your collections? Is it giving you a return? So, you know, again, from a military perspective, again, like from the bare bones, basic, like you want to be able to have what's in your burger and, you know, on your webbing, and that's it, be cool for the next 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, whatever it is. And it really does feel like that what we're doing is actually really taking it back to simplicity, right? It's stripping it back and saying the stuff that you do every day, the problems that you have every day, imagine coming and spending a day with me and never having that problem again. If somebody had promised me that and they could save me all that time, yeah, of me practicing with Greta Curve by myself and then getting trained by Denny, being the only man in the world to be mentored by him, and then saving all that aggro and just packaging that up so you could do an online course first and then come and spend a day with me. And then you could literally fast track all of that. You know, to me, that is that's super exciting, right? But it's less incumbent on having the need for technology such as scanners and this and that. It's not that. This is saying the stuff that you do, right, every day, that whether you're NHS or private.
World-class basics. Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? That's amazing. I'm stealing that, Andy.
It's amazing. The OTC impact upon you after all these years.
Yes. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. To keep with the military analogies, then, you've got lots of battle scars. What's your best day in business and your worst day in business? You've done a lot of stuff. What do the extremes look like?
Yeah. Your parachute not opening and then opening?
Yeah.
It's difficult because there's a lot, right? But I think the high moment, like, you know, the absolute high is like, you know, when you've actually delivered a program and it's just knocked the socks off everybody. You know, and then not only that, when they come back to you, and look, there's some dark moments sometimes, there's some difficult parts, you know, like there's this, you know, doing business is full of conflict, right? You know, you have, you're dealing with people, right? And guess what? People are wonderful, but they're also not. Yeah, they're also the opposite of wonderful, right? And so dealing with that can also be very, like, disheartening sometimes, and it can get you down for a good period of time. And then I'll get a message from someone that goes, mate, I've just grossed 5.3K today. This is mind boggling. And this is a 27-year-old dentist, and it blows my mind if I could gross 5.3K in a day, yeah, doing basic dentistry, right? The, you know, first class, what do you say? World-class basics, like doing that. So yeah, then that just fully just inflates me up again. I'm like, come, this is why I'm doing it. This is what you're doing it for. And not everybody's measure of success is money, right? Other people are not coming to us because they want to, you know, we train dentists and therapists to gross 2 to 4K a day on average, right? But that's not what everyone comes for. Some people come because they want to be part of a supportive community. Some people come because they want the respect of their peers. Some people come because patient care is at the forefront of that. So we make sure not to, you know, superimpose our definition of success onto other people, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the high moments, like when people come to you and say, look, man, this is really changed the game. Like, what have you got next? When can I do the next program? Like, you know, when can I see? I want to come to the clinic. I want to watch you. You know, like, that's super cool, right? You're making a difference. It's contribution rather than, you know, look at my car, right? This is different. This is like, you know, sharing the gospel, so to speak. So that's pretty high. A down moment. I remember a down moment of that. This was a stressful moment dealing with a contractor. And, you know, I treat everyone in good faith. Like, I think everyone's a good actor until they prove otherwise. And that can go against you. But at the same time, I'm still probably not going to change my ways in that regard, because the benefits of that, creating long-term relationships and stuff that's come from this, and people are on board who see the mission as you do, you know, who want to be want to work alongside you, has come from trusting. It hasn't come from me being scrutinizing. So I just accept that it's the cost of business. The cost of business is you're going to come across these people, going to be with you in 10 years. You're going to sit at dinner going, mate, what a cracking decade that's been. And there are other people that aren't going to be with you. You know, as I say this quite often. I say many people will start that race with you. Very few will end it with you. You know, and so I've just accepted enough of that. And I remember actually having an experience with a contractor who, at the time, again, it was an emotional decision because I needed somebody on board to fulfill this part of the business very quickly. We did that, good working relationship, but there were fibs along the line. along, you know, fibs that I didn't pick up on. An example was, oh, you have to use our software because if you use it, they'll kick you off the platform, which turns out to be utter bullshit-tacky, right? And so I fell for that. And then at the end, when this contract relationship terminated for whatever reason, I'm sweating there going, shit, I don't really own the IP right now. He does. And that was like a pivotal moment. And that got me down for a day or two because I was like, how have I cocked up on such a decision like that, right? And it's really, that's my point. Emotions play such a part because you want to get moving. You want to move fast. You want to make things happen. You want to, you know, you want to do it, right? And so as a result, it's messy at the beginning. You know, startup land is very messy, I'd say. But that actually got me down. But I'd say that one of my superpowers, so to speak, is I recover very quickly. You know, so like, you know, everyone goes down, but it's how quick you go up, right? I mean, I haven't dropped this in here yet, but you know, one of my hobbies is boxing, and that's all about, mate, take that lick to the face and get up, carry on.
Yeah. Well, it's funny when you were saying about your lowest point, you actually said I was down for a day or two. That shows your resilience and your ability to bounce back quickly, because lots of people, when they talk about the thing that hit them hardest, they'd have dragged that round as baggage for weeks or months, or they may never leave it. But your ability to accept the hit on the chin and just move on. And I think a lot of this, we kind of, it's threaded through the whole conversation today, but I think that military experience when you're at dental school really has given you an outlook and a structure and an approach to life and business that I think I've not really heard that common across dentistry.
No, not at all.
I think you're quite unusual in how you think and how you approach things and how you prepare to have this kind of just keep pushing forward mentality. And I think a lot of that does sit back with some of that early
days
training.
Done is done, isn't it? Yeah. I think that's the key thing. Done is done. You can't do much about it.
What I think is brilliant is you're still a young guy and you've already tried so many things and you've now found a thing that you are so passionate about. And there's, you've still got decades ahead of you, which is so exciting.
Sure. I appreciate that. You mentioned about resilience and stuff as well. I think it's quite interesting too. It's almost like you look at like an Olympic athlete and then he's won the gold. You see that fleeting moment. You don't actually see everything that went into that. So actually, I'm relatively resilient now, but I wasn't always that way. And it's the experiences, the knowledge and the skills that you amass that all culminate to actually say to yourself, actually being resilient is probably the thing that's going to help me quite a lot. Right. And, not really paying too much attention to things that, you know, Napoleon said this quote that really sticks with me. He says, space, I can recover. Time, never. And so for me, that's analogous with many, many things. You know, space, that's, you know, in a military sense, can be, for us, it could be resources. It could be, you know, money. It could be, whatever. But for me, that's what it is, right? You know, I can recover many, many things, but time not. So I pick my battles. There are certain things that, you know, you could have a dispute over a couple of grand. Am I going to pursue that? Probably not. It's not worth my time at this stage. 5 years ago, I'd probably fight tooth and nail for that 2 grand. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Well, you say about we can't recover time. I think we're up on time, Sonny. We could talk all day. We could talk all day. There's so many things that we could deep into, but we need to ask you two questions before we leave you to go boxing or educating or clinical delivery or whatever it is you've got going on this afternoon. Yeah. So the first question we have for you is, if you could be a fly on a wall somewhere, what would that situation be? When would it be? Who would be there?
I'm intrigued on this one.
Yeah, me too.
I tell you what, this is a recent one, you know. Again, these questions, they would have been different answers at different points in my life, but this is quite interesting to me at the minute. I think, you know, when a president gets sworn in and they do the oath and all that, I would love to be on the wall after that bit, where these five gentlemen come in black suits and say, Mr. President, we need to talk about Area 51. You know, and just what is it? That, you know, the most powerful man in the world actually needs to know at that point that he didn't know prior to that. I think that's a pretty interesting thing to know.
And not being too political, maybe he just couldn't remember he'd been sworn in.
there have been some relatively Asian presidents over
there. Have been some very Asian presidents, and there seems to be quite a big one at the moment. Yes. Anyway, moving on from my political moment.
And our follow-up is, if you could meet somebody, you could sit down with somebody and have a chat with them and find out about them, who would that be? Who would you like to meet?
This is interesting.
Again, this question changes, like, you know, over the time, but actually right now I think paying homage to a guy called Howard Ferran. So he's the guy who set up Dental Town. and Dentistry Uncensored podcast, right? So, and I was listening to that quite religiously. He's a very cool guy, very funny, very down to earth, tells you how he is, very successful in his own right as well.
He's very brash, isn't he? I like his style.
I love it, his style as well. But, you know, not only do I think he's a fantastic mentor, his book, Uncomplicated Business, I recommend that to any dentist. I listen to that audiobook every year just to refresh me on, like, center me. But if it wasn't for him and setting up that podcast, and I wouldn't have heard Dr. Brown on the podcast, and I wouldn't have reached out to him, and I wouldn't have received that mentorship that actually changed my life, right? And that same thing that we're now offering to the world, right, and sharing that message.
Brilliant.
Interesting.
That's absolutely fabulous, Sonny. Thank you for your time. Honestly, I think your stories are great. I think the way your whole life is joined up, there's a real relationship between all the things you've done. And whilst it's dived off down weird old alleys and you've kind of come back and tried things, there's a real sense of you are now on a path which you're passionate about. And I love that.
It's an embodiment of if at first you don't succeed,
yes,
try and try again, you know, find something, keep going, keep getting up.
Yeah. Cheers, Sonny. We'll let you go. Thank you for your time. It really is appreciated.
Yeah, fascinating.
Wish you all the success in the world going forward. And hopefully we're going to bump into another an event or a function sometime soon.
Andy, Chris, legends. Thank you.
Love Cheers, it. Man. Cheers. Thanks, Sonny.
Keep well. Cheers.
Take care, yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.